The following is a presentation of the Matt Talk Podcast Network.
Welcome to On the Mat. I am Kyle Klingman of the National Wrestling Hall of Fame Dan Gable Museum, joined by the filet mignon of wrestling, Andy Hamilton of TrackWrestling.com. Welcome, Andy.
Happy New Year, Kyle.
Great to have you back. It's been a couple weeks. I don't like taking a week off.
I know.
It doesn't feel right.
It feels like it's been a year.
Well, it was last year. I would actually like to have more shows than take one away, but there's a reason you were in South Beach for the South Beach Duels, but I'm glad you're back. You had
Philadelphia ever beat
Philadelphia. Philadelphia. You've been all over the map.
New York, Delaware.
Good trips?
Yeah. Yeah, for the most part. Dealt with a little upper respiratory issue down in Fort Lauderdale that kind of sapped me a little bit, but I'm on the mend. Otherwise, it's really good wrestling, though.
I would think that being in warm weather, it would be the opposite. So you got a little upper respiratory.
Yeah, I drew the short straw. You know, you think back to the luck that we had on the way to and from Budapest, where we were drawing the back row, back middle. And I had a flight home from Philadelphia to Chicago. Lady in the middle was coughing her lungs up. And flight from Houston to Fort Lauderdale, little boy sitting next to me was coughing like crazy. I'm like, I have no chance. So
went downhill.
Yep.
It went downhill. Let's do our mailbag right away. Kelly DeShutter, who we talked about a couple shows ago, she sent a message saying that she listens to the show, first of all, but she was talking about PDI, which I think is a topic we will continue to develop, point differential index. And she said, if you look at the Ohio State Arizona State meet, which took place on November 18th, Arizona State lost that meet 22-17. Miles Martin and Colin Moore were not in that dual meet, so some things would change. But Ohio State won 22-17. But she said, if you look at PDI, if we went with the proposed scoring that we would like to have, Arizona State would have actually won that meet 82-76. And I think this is a good example of what we want to get accomplished with this. I like that score. It sounds like a basketball score. It sounds like exactly what wrestling needs. And I think this does what we want it to do. It's close in the scoring. If you give Arizona State the fall with Norfleet with getting a fall, he got 22 points for the team, and that really was what ultimately made the difference. And we want falls to matter. And you had a great interview with Mark Branch about this very topic, and it sounds like there's some promising things happening.
Yeah, I got a chance to talk to Mark for 22 minutes down at the South Beach Duels the day before the event started, and he was the chair of the rules committee the last couple of years, on that committee for 6 seasons, and give me some insight on it. We talked about a lot of stuff. We talked about the push-out rule and whether a pure push-out has been on the table and why they didn't go down that road. But also brought up this topic we've been talking about for months here. Dual scoring, point differential, cumulative scoring, that type of stuff. And he said that it was talked about at length. He said it was maybe the topic that was discussed the most in their spring meetings, which is fascinating, right?
Yeah, did that surprise you that would have gotten brought? Because it surprised me when you told me about it or we watched the interview.
It's not surprising that they brought it up. It's surprising that it was brought up as prominently as it was. Because, Kyle, in our lifetime, this is the way duels have been scored. You're talking how far back? You're a historian. How far back do you have to go that a decision is worth 3 points? You know, we had some stuff in there where, like, a period where there were superior decisions.
Yeah.
And in between the major and the tech, there's a superior.
Correct. Yeah.
But just doesn't feel like there's been a whole lot of discussion about this outside of you and me talking about it. I haven't heard a lot of people talking about
it. Well, yeah. And when we ask our guests, about this or ask the college coaches, they're usually surprised and they say, ooh, I've really never thought about this. And in watching the interview with Mark, I think the question becomes, how do you manage tournaments? And when I heard that, my immediate thought was, why not just make it cumulative and have the same type of scoring system in tournaments? I haven't thought through it enough to understand that would be massive scores, but what's wrong with just cumulative scoring the same way that you would do a dual meet? I don't know that it changes a whole lot. I think it has some potential. So why not just go with that type of system? And you'll see some really, really high scores at that point. It needs to be fleshed out, of course. Yeah. I'm just thinking about this on the fly when I saw the interview. But all that being said is I think there's some real potential for this to happen. And it just piggybacks on the same conversation. I had a two-hour conversation with Mike Moyer of the National Wrestling Coaches Association at Midlands. And he went back to the same comment. He said, the reason dual meets don't have any flavor is because there's no uncertainty and the dual meet results don't matter. And we talked about this. Why did the Iowa State-Iowa meet feel so fun and have such a great vibe? Because there was uncertainty. You didn't know what was going to happen after the halftime. You start looking at the scoreboard. You start tabulating. What if this guy does this? And then at the end, DeSanto's on his back, and then he's chasing after him. That's a blast. And it was uncertain. But the dual meet result still doesn't matter. It doesn't lead to anything. It doesn't have any build. We have to get back to that. That's a separate point. But if we do have a system in place where the dual meet scores are fun and innovative and you can be looking at the scoreboard every single time because every single point matters, I think by virtue of that, it adds uncertainty and it adds an extra incentive to why wrestlers need to score points.
Couple things come to mind here for me. Down in Fort Lauderdale, had one of our listeners, Scott Honecker, head coach at Williams College, came up to me and was talking about listening to the show. And we started talking about some of these situations and the hard part being that tournament element. And you're right. Maybe you add cumulative scoring. Maybe you bump up the placement points substantially to where we're seeing like swimming type scores. So that's in my head a little bit. And then the other thing, Kyle, I don't think we're trying to change the outcome of duels. We're trying to improve wrestling and improve the quality of wrestling to where if you're up 4-1 in the third period, you're not coasting to the finish line. You're trying to add points because it has an effect on your team performance. So if you're winning 7-1, you're getting rewarded more than if you're winning 4-1. We think the wrestling will be better. That's first and foremost, right? I mean, that's what we're trying to see.
Yeah. And with that, you said the 7-1 or 4-1, there's a huge incentive for that guy who is down 7-1 to score, to make it 7-3, because you just picked up two more team points for your team. And I think that has to matter because you want to put something on the board that says every single point you score is going to have incentive behind it, whether it's stalling, whether it's back points, whether it's reversals, everything's going to tabulate. And because of that, I think that does add an exciting product because now there's incentive. It's saying you have to score. If you hold on to an 8-1 lead, shame on you. You can separate because everything you do has consequences, good or bad. And I think that's what we want to see. We want to see, you're right, take that product to another level. It's enhancing the overall product of the sport.
I would like to do a study of maybe, I don't know, 100 dual meets that are within, say, 6-7 points and see how many of the outcomes change. Now, we haven't come up with many that the outcomes would change, but there are a few. I'm sure there's got to be a bunch already, you know, with the data that we've been able to accumulate throughout the season.
And even for the fans alone, as we talk about how you market and brand the sport, I can't tell you how many people that have been in the sport for 20 years, and they're casual fans, but they'll ask, hey, what is a major decision? What does it take to get to that point? Or they just can't remember that it's 8 points that gets you to a major decision. You're taking all that away. You're just saying, you score a point, you get points for your team, and a fall's worth 22. Pretty simple.
Yeah.
And I think that's the element we want to get to. I'd love to get to the Mark Branch interview. I think we want to put that in here so that listeners can really get insight from Mark Branch. So let's go to Mark Branch right now.
Kyle Klingman and I, for our On the Mat podcast, we've been banging the drum about changing dual scoring.
Yes.
We think that, you know, if you win 7-0 with 4 minutes of riding time, you ought to be rewarded a little bit more than if you win by 1 second in the ultimate tiebreaker. Was there any discussion on that and your thoughts on that?
Our meeting in the spring, that was probably the premier subject.
Really?
It really was. Now, here's the problem. And we worked with Pat Tosse, and Pat came up with something 2 or 3 years ago. He came up with, a different scoring scenario, and he ran it through, we were trying to do, what can we do with a dual scoring that somewhat translates over to a tournament scoring so that our fans kind of understand them. And, you know, so that's kind of the ultimate, but the discussion as far as just changing dual scoring only is still there too. That's pretty simple to do. But if you're wanting to try to tie it to tournament as well, which ultimately is what we want to do. I mean, that's in my mind, I'm like the hardest thing for an expert fan, a fan who's been going to the NCAA tournament for 15 years. Tell me why Wyoming has, 60 points at the NCAA tournament. Tell me how. They were like, I have no idea.
Yeah.
You know, it's so complicated. And I know that because I've been in the sport forever. And it's still like when I'm scoring a tournament, it takes me like everybody, I need to be in a room, quiet by myself, no distractions. I need a calculator. I need a pencil. So I'm going to be erasing everything. So I know that like we would like to make that simple for fans, because to me, if fans don't know how you get to a point, that may be something that is holding us back as a sport that we don't even recognize. Because what? Everybody can score a football game.
Yeah.
Everybody can score a basketball game. Nobody goes, how did you get that? Everybody understands football scoring, basketball scoring. You look at two of the bigger sports in American popularity, and we want to be right there with them, but you can't score it. You know, and we want the casual fan, the new fan, to be able to walk in and go, oh, I get this. All right, I can pick it up. So that's the hard thing, is try to do them both.
Yeah.
Get them on a similar platform and then move them, in some. And I love some of those ideas about even like one of my favorite ideas is a point scored is a point earned. That way, even if you're the guy on the team, on a dual team, that maybe you're not the best, but you still have an incentive to go out there and fight for your team because you can make a difference. You may go out there and get pinned in the end. You may get teched in the end. But you can go out there and give yourself a reason to fight for every second of the match because there's, so I think there's some great concepts out there. I know when it comes to trying to get them together, basically, we talked about it. And we were like, we need somebody from MIT to work on this. And so that's where I left it. I said, if you don't get somebody started on it now, then when the rule session comes in the spring, we're going to be where we've always been, talking about it, not getting anything done. So hopefully it is something that's still at the forefront, because I think it could help us, and again, we need to look at the fans and go, let's make sure when the dust settles, the fans know how to score it. Because if not, I think we're shooting ourselves in the foot.
So that was an interview that Andy had with Mark Branch at the South Beach Duels. Mark Branch was a two-time NCAA wrestling champion for Oklahoma State. Now he's the head wrestling coach at Wyoming. A lot of great content right there and some insight from someone who had a style that was good from the top position, likes near fall points, but very pragmatic in his approach and how cumulative scoring can help and that it's being talked about, which surprises me because I didn't think that they were on this level thinking about the long-term future of the sport in this kind of way. Some different topics there, but overall, I'm very, very pleased with what Mark had to say about the growth of the sport.
Yeah, and from the sounds of it, I think the reason that something hasn't happened already is because they want to figure that tournament element out and how that works. because I think what they want to do is they want to change it one time. They don't want to change it just for dual scoring now and then leave the tournament element alone and then change the tournament element later. I think they want to make one change. That makes sense to me. I think they'll get there. I think I hope that they keep their foot on the pedal and continue to press the issue here to try to figure this out. Hopefully they continue to look at it now and we see changes in the not so distant future.
And you don't want it to be like international wrestling was. They've done a lot better job, but where they're changing the rules so frequently that you just drive yourself crazy that they're changing rules right before the world championships. I like that. You want to make sure you vet it to the point where this is really tried and true, and then you don't get to that situation where day one you start implementing it and then there's these big red flags and you say, what did we get ourselves into? You really do want to make sure it's properly managed, that people understand it, but you still have to get to it. I hope 10 years from now, we're not having the same conversation about PDI and saying, oh, we should have done this, should have done that. It really does need to change. If you think about it, and I like what you said, in our lifetime, we haven't known anything but, and I think that it's easy just to say, this is the way it's been, and this is how dual scoring is always going to be. No, there's a better way, and a much better way, and I think we have part of what the answer can be.
Yeah, and I think to 2000, my first year covering the NCAA championships, and the Wednesday news conference before the tournament, there were probably 10 minutes during that news conference that were devoted to discussion about moving the season away from March Madness. And Jay Robinson was the one leading the charge then. And it got brought up year after year after year after year. And here we are 19 years later and nothing has changed. So sometimes it takes us a while to get moving on stuff. And things, like I said, get shifted to the back burner. We forget about them. It's not front and center in our minds until, you know, it comes about March or thereabouts. And how can we make the sport better? How can we make the NCAA championships better? Well, we get sidetracked and time passes. And here we are 19 years later. Nothing's changed.
The only thing I can think that's changed is we no longer have the national duels. It wasn't an NCAA sanctioned event, but it was something that mattered and something you could hang your hat on and put in your trophy case, because it was a big event, arguably the second biggest event behind the NCAA championships. We've lost that. We no longer have that as an outlet, so we don't have a meaningful dual meet event that captures our imagination. And for those who are only getting into the sport right now, what a special event it was. Some of my best wrestling memories came from that national dual meet championship, and we no longer have it in any capacity. And that's a sad loss for the sport, because if anything, we've regressed a little bit because we don't have it anymore.
Yeah, and what we'd be coming up on it, right? A decade ago, it would be the weekend after this.
Yep.
Right down the street, 9 blocks away.
With every team. Not every team, but every division. Women's, NAIA, junior college, all the divisions in the NCAA. We're missing it right now, and it's sad. Now they still have the multi-divisional nationals with non-division one, but it just doesn't have the same bang at all.
Remember the year that Barry Zito showed up?
I do. That was great.
He just signed that $126 million contract with the Giants. And like weeks later, he's at the national duels.
Yeah.
Everybody's like, what in the world is Barry Zito doing here?
And he becomes friends with Ben Askren while he's there, and they build a relationship. And
didn't he call John Smith like in the middle of the night too or something?
I don't know. All I know is he had a meeting with Gable over at the wrestling museum that day. He came over and toured the museum and had a private meeting with him. So it seems surreal that a Cy Young Award winner was at the national duels, but it happened. And again, stranger than fiction, you can't make this up. So that was a great memory. But speaking of national duels, we have a guest today that was part of that. And Minnesota has won numerous national dual meet championships, although we don't have it anymore. The head wrestling coach for Minnesota right now is Brandon Eggum. So he is going to be our guest on the show today. But before we get into that, our topic from our last show was about the strongest weight class in NCAA championship history. And I'm going to say, and you would say this too, 2008 is number one.
F-149.
At 149. No question about it. Just running the math on this. Every person in the top eight, we did this last time, was at least in the finals once. Every wow. single person. There are a total of six NCAA champions that won eight total NCAA championship titles. And then if you go down to everyone that was in the bracket, there were 13 appearances in the NCAA championship finals and then nine NCAA finalists total in that bracket.
And a five-time World and Olympic champ.
And a five-time World and Olympic champ. And you have a guy in Brent Metcalf who made four world teams. That's number one. I don't know how you argue that. However, what I want to do is just talk about some of the other brackets. And so I'm going to give a little incentive to anyone who listens. There were eight NCAA championships won among all of the competitors in 2008 at 149. There's actually a weight class in a different year that has more total NCAA championships. And if you can contact us and figure out which one it is, the Gable Museum will give you a prize pack. Now, when I say that, it's not individuals that won it. It's total NCAA championships that
were won. For example, in 149, Metcalf won two, Burroughs won two, Caldwell won one, Schlater won one, Jenkins won one, O'Connor.
O'Connor won one. Yep. So that's eight total.
Okay. So well, what's the number of titles that's been won, Kyle?
The total number is 10.
10. Okay.
Yep. And I'll just give you a hint. There were six in this weight class in 2008. There were less than that for this particular weight bracket and weight class. So if you can figure that out, we'll give you a prize pack from the Gable Museum. So I'm not going to give that away, but I just also want to mention a couple other years. And I also want to get Andy's take on this. First of all, 1999 is an interesting year. I think it's one of the weight classes that deserves to be in the mix for one of the best weight classes of all time. 1999 at 133, Eric Guerrero, a three-timer. Cody Sanderson, a two-time finalist. Eric Juergens, a two-timer. Placed at least third. So he goes 3-3-1-1. Lost to Eric Larkin and then beats Stephen Abbas twice to come back for third his freshman year. Beats Johnny Thompson in 2001, who was a two-timer eventually. Beat Cody Sanderson, a two-time finalist. Eric Larkin was fourth that year. Stan Green was fifth. Eric Keller, who's the head wrestling coach at Wartburg. Eric Holker, who was an NCAA champion for Iowa State eventually, was at BYU at the time. And then Robert Sesley. What I want to get from you is why doesn't Eric Juergens get as much love as he deserves? Here's a guy who only lost one match his final 2 years, two-time NCAA champion, places third the first 2 years, but nobody really talks about him. Any idea why?
I think a couple reasons. Number one, like he was a two-timer at Iowa, and so really to crack the upper echelon, you have to win three, right? The three-timers are the ones that we talk about the most, right?
Yeah, there's been six.
Or if, you know, maybe like you're a two-timer like Ironside and you add a Hodge to it. Metcalf won two and had a Hodge.
And four world teams.
Yep.
Yep. Alger was two plus a world silver medal. Randy Lewis, two plus an Olympic gold medal. Chuck Yeagla, two plus an Olympic team. So that fits in.
So there's that. And also, I think the thing that hurt Juergens a little bit was the fact that the guys that were around him, I mean, there were so many stars on that team. You had Strittmatter at 125, Schwab at 141, Mike Zadek at 149, TJ Williams at 157. And so Juergens was never like the star, like shining star on his own team at that time. And at the beginning of his career, it was Ironside. So maybe that has something to do with it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
if he had gone on and made a couple world teams or won a world medal, something along those lines, I think maybe we'd think of him a little bit more of an all-time great, although he was.
Yeah.
There'd be more discussion of him as an all-time great, but had an incredible career absolutely incredible career. And there's one less NCAA title trophy in the Iowa case without Eric Juergens. He won the match that Iowa had to have in 2000 in the 133-pound finals with Cody Sanderson. Cody Sanderson wins that match. Iowa State wins an NCAA title. Juergens got the takedown in overtime, and title stayed in Iowa City.
Yeah, and a guy that I think deserves more credit, four-time state champion from Iowa, and as we mentioned, his credentials. So he's someone that I wanted to bring up. And then just a few other weight classes that were interesting. 2005, you had Chris Pendleton, Ben Askren, and Jake Herbert going 1-2-3. They were all eventual two-time NCAA champions. And then the next year in 2006, you have Askren, Herbert, and then Mark Perry, all eventual two-time NCAA champions, all at 174. So you have back-to-back years where the top three were all two-timers. And as we look at that, we missed out on Ben Askren and Mark Perry ever competing against each other in college. What do you think that match would have looked like?
I think it would have been a lot of fun. I think it would have been wild. I think Askren was, when they were in the same weight class, Mark Perry was never, that was a year he was dealing with like the neck issues. And I don't know that he was at that. I mean, as time proved that season, he wasn't quite at Ben's level. I mean, because he couldn't get over the top against Herbert, and Herbert got handled in the finals against Askren. Yeah. But boy, it would been a lot of fun, right? I mean, we would have seen some incredible scrambles.
You hope so. You hope they would open it up.
Two of the all-time greatest scramblers in college wrestling history.
Yeah, if right there, I would put them both in the top 10. I haven't thought about it enough, but I would definitely feel comfortable saying they're both in the top 10, and they both knew their positions in counter wrestling. So if you got in on them, it wasn't going to be a sure thing by any means.
And it was sometimes just part of the battle.
Yeah, it was you would hope that they would live up to what the hype would be, because they're both offensive minded and wanting to put on a show. And I just wish that would have materialized, and we never got that chance. It was the only year, as you said, Mark Perry went up to 174, and we missed out on that chance. And it just would have been a lot of fun. I think there would have been more than 10 points total on that match.
I wish we could have seen Mark Perry fully healthy throughout his college career.
Yeah, was he ever fully healthy? Did he ever have that one year where he felt good?
I don't know. Dealt with the neck issue his sophomore year, and we've talked to him about that too, right? I mean,
yeah,
just some of the things that limited him from doing. He shot a lot of double legs early in his career, like when he first got to Iowa, and then that kind of went away. It was unfortunate we didn't get to see the best Mark Perry, but the Mark Perry we got to see was pretty incredible.
Yeah, and the wins he pulled out, because there were some head-scratching losses that he had along the way, but I think it was from just not even training whatsoever. He just went out dry. From what I understand is that he didn't have any training at all. He just went out and gave it a shot, and there were a couple losses where you just didn't think it was going to happen for him. And then what does he do at the NCAA championships as he wins the darn thing?
I remember the year that I think it was his senior year that he won Midlands. And I think it was Dan LeClaire telling me this story about how Perry was like 8 pounds over the night after, after the first night of the Midlands. And they were like, how are you 8 pounds over? You know, didn't you wrestle today? You know, didn't you wrestle like four matches? And he goes, yeah, well, I pinned everybody in the first period. And he did. I think it was like in the first minute and a half that he pinned everybody. And then they're like, well, what about your warm-up? Didn't you warm up? He's like, no, it was like it was cold in the back or something like that. Or the mat, you know, there wasn't mat space in the back. And so I didn't warm up. I just went out there. So he went out there cold and rolled up like three or four guys in the first minute and a half on the first day of Midlands. So
total Mark Perry. Total Mark Perry. So those were interesting brackets. A couple other ones. 1997 at heavyweight, right here at the Uni Dome. Kerry McCoy wins it that year. He was a two-timer, ends up being a world silver medalist in 2003. Stephen Neal was second. He was a world champion in 99. And then Tolly Thompson was third. He ended up being a world bronze medalist in 2005. So 1, 2, 3, you have three world medalists. Then you go down the line. Jason Gleesman at seventh was a Greco-Roman Olympian, so that was an interesting bracket as well. 2015, of course, You have Kyven Gadsden's on top of the heap. He pins Kyle Snyder. We know what he's done, three-time world and Olympic champion. And then in fifth place was Jaden Cox, a three-timer eventually, who just won a world championship, bronze medalist in 2016 at the Olympics, and then bronze medalist at the world championships. So some firepower there as well. 2001, Cale Sanderson was a four-timer. He was an Olympian, Olympic champion. Daniel Cormier, the guy he faced in the finals, was a two-time Olympian, four-time world team member. Andy Rovat was an Olympian. And then Damian Hahn got fifth that year. He was a two-time NCAA champ. And then Rob Roan didn't place. He was an eventual NCAA champ. And Josh Lambrecht was in that weight class as well, and he was a finalist. And then the final one here, 1982, Mark Schultz and Ed Bannick met in the finals. Both those guys ended up being Olympic wrestling champions. Jim Shear was also in that weight class, and he was an Olympian. Matt Reese was a one-time NCAA champion for North Carolina State. That was 1982 in the 177-pound weight class. But another piece of trivia here, the only time world champion against world champion ever took place was Dake against Taylor in 2013. No two.
Wow.
Never has there been two eventual world champions in the finals of the NCAA championships until Dake and Taylor.
I'm intrigued by the number 10 titles in one weight class. Give our listeners at least a clue. It's got to be in the last, like, say, 30 years, right?
It does.
Okay.
And my clue would be look for a wide range of guys that won multiple titles, because it happened from a few guys that won a lot. And I guess that's the only clue I can give you, or else I'm going to give it away. So look for a ton of titles out of a few guys.
Okay.
So that's my clue. And I'm going to clue you in that we have Brandon Eggum on the line here, and we're in for a good interview. What do you say we get to the head wrestling coach at Minnesota?
Sounds good.
Our guest today is the head wrestling coach at the University of Minnesota. He's a world silver medalist in 2001, and most importantly, the fourth best wrestler out of Montana. It's Brandon Eggum. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, I like this list because there are some interesting names on that list. Bill Zadick, Mike Zadick's on the list. You have Matt Ruppel from Lehigh, but one of the names that I'd like to get your thoughts on, Larry Quizzle, was number 9 on the list. He was during your era, I think the same graduation year as you, and he passed away recently. What do you remember about Larry?
Yeah, just, he was a great person. I got to spend a little bit of time with him, growing up at camps and stuff, but he was a hard-nosed wrestler, and probably some of my earlier memories of him is just, watching him wrestle at the high school state tournaments and some of those things. But, Montana's a big state, so we had some distance between us. But, the wrestling community is a tight-knit family, and he was a great person.
With it being a big state as far as size, maybe not as far as population, do you know these icons? Do you know the Gene Davises all the way to Reese Andy, Jarrett Deegan, of course, still wrestling in college right now? Do you keep a pulse on these guys from Montana?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like you said, there's not a ton of wrestlers that come out of Montana, but all these names are guys that I was really familiar with and I had a chance to, bump into or talk to many times in my life and stuff like that. So those are all big names coming out of Montana as a younger kid. Some of the older ones that you talked about, those are guys I looked up to. And then the Zadicks I had the ability to, at the junior national training camp, spend some time with those guys. Mike was, Bill was at Iowa, wrestling for Iowa at the time, and came back and helped with our camp. And when I was wrestling the junior nationals, he spent a little time with me in between some of the sessions, just on some technique and stuff. And they're just great people, all of them. So
one of the storylines that Andy and I have been talking quite a bit about this past year in 2018 was backups that got their opportunity at the world championships, regardless of level. You were in that situation in 2001 where Cale made the team, but you filled in and got a world silver medal. How did you compartmentalize that? How did you make that an opportunity so that you could have a successful world championship run?
I know that I compete. I had great training partners here and Tim Hartung and great coaching staff and, you know, just going to the, you know, Olympic Training Center, those camps and stuff. I knew that I could compete well with those guys. And so I was confident in my abilities. To have that opportunity open up like that and the way it did was unique. And I was really thankful that I had the ability to, take advantage of it. But, I think like anything at that, you know, there's a small line sometimes, difference from, taking first or second. And so I just wanted to make sure that when I went out there and competed that I felt like I was ready. And training wise, I had good partners and I went into it. And, as I wrestled, I just remember thinking like I tried not to focus on winning the match, but just looking at the small things and the small scrambles and winning each situation and keeping it simple like that. And that was like where my focus was. I know that was probably one of the things that I did a little bit different than I thought, you know, maybe not as much in my college career. I kind of looked at things a little maybe differently, but it kind of helped me in that moment. And so it was a great opportunity. It was a long time ago, but I know I was really grateful for it. And I was fortunate that I had a really great weekend out there. So.
Minnesota wrestling is now a household name thanks to 3 team championships and a slew of success over the course of the last 25 years. But when you got recruited, it was still on that upward swing. When you were getting recruited from Montana, what do you remember about that process? And what did you get pitched on as far as coming to the University of Minnesota to be a Golden Gopher?
The big thing was trying to be part of something special. Like I wanted to create something. Really talked about, you know, making this move and this climb to make Minnesota a national powerhouse and the goal of winning a national title as a team. And, I love that, you know, just as far as, you know, you see a lot of kids, it's exciting, I'm sure, to go to the place that has established, those, you know, credentials already and is the top team. That can be exciting too. But I was really, excited about the opportunity to be part of it, to build it and to know that, that the people around me were trying to chase that same thing and overcome some goals like that. And so the coaching staff that was here at the time, Jay Robinson and Marty Morgan and Joe Russell and Mark Schwab. And there's a lot of other great people around the program at that time as well. But, those guys had a big dream there and I believed in it. And, so it was exciting. I liked their work ethic here. You know, what they talked about, like outworking the rest of the competition and, growing up in Sydney, Montana, my high school coach, Guy Melby, believed in that same philosophy. So it was really something that I was familiar with. And I liked that grinded out, you know, a very intense type coaching style. And so I felt comfortable with it here. I felt like when I came on my recruiting trip, I remember like just being around different programs and going on other recruiting trips and feeling like maybe the teams weren't as close. They were kind of like you'd see. Felt like there was like groups together and like some guys were hanging out with others, but it was just kind of clicky like that. And at Minnesota, I remember on my weekend here, just seeing the whole team together and everyone was joking around and just seemed like it was a better family environment. And maybe being a kid from the Midwest, maybe that was part of it too. I just felt like I connected a little bit more with the guys and the team here. And, I was from a small town, so coming to the city was something I was a little bit nervous of, but Minneapolis is such a, you know, just a cool city that I liked it. I know I was nervous. Like I said, I grew up in a small farming community, but, I also wanted to take a journey and do something cool like that. And the thought of being in Minneapolis was intriguing to me. And so, I do remember, my first week driving up, coming up to school, driving up to Minneapolis, and I had an old Nova that my dad had given me, and I barely got me to the dorms here. But I remember when I pulled in, just the first 2 year of guys that lived in the dorms, they all came rushing out. They'd already been there for a couple of days, and you know, they hardly knew me for the most part, but it was just really cool. And so from there, it just felt like a perfect fit.
During that era, there's about a decade long streak where Minnesota just felt like you guys were going to get after it. You guys were hungry. It was raw. It was everything you would want in a program that's striving to get to the top. Do you feel like that just materialized organically, or was that a message that got sent through the coaching staff? How did you get to that point where it was just complete hunger to get that championship?
Yeah, I think the coaching staff did a big part of it. I think they recruited guys that believed in that same philosophy and wanted the same things, that academics and wrestling was extremely important to the guys on the team at that time. And I think having that belief and in the, you know, having the coaching staff in place to do the same things made a big, put that in place, no doubt about it. And so it's something that I know it's not easy, but if you believe in yourself and your team and stuff, I think it's capable. And I think they did a great job. And I look back there just seeing the way that they developed the guys in the team. That was important because they weren't getting the best guys, you know. And I think, you know, they talk a lot about, everyone's always talking about recruiting. Recruiting's important and very important, but it's not just about getting the best guys, and it's about getting the right guys. And I think that was a big step that they took there, and making sure that they did their duty there to make sure they're getting the right types of kids that had the right attitude and all those things in place. And that's important. You see it in the world today all the time, recruiting wise, there's guys that come out, and boy, it's hard. It's a very competitive world. You want to win. And so sometimes you see a guy that, this guy could help. He can win a lot of matches, but at the same time, he might not be the right fit for this program, or the type of guy that I want to bring in. And I think that that's important. And so you look over history at times, and people slide and they take chances and risk, and sometimes it'll come back to bite you. But the coaching staff there at Minnesota did an awesome job, and they made us believe that we could win. And the guys in the team had a strong desire. And before you know it, we're, like you said, we have had a decade of just a very strong dominance in the Division I wrestling world. So it was awesome.
Jay Robinson had such a big print on this sport and beyond it, just well known, left a great legacy. Now that he's out as the head wrestling coach, and clearly you're in that position, what do you want to create? What kind of culture do you want at Minnesota?
It's just, you know, it's the same thing that we talked about there. I mean, the fortunate thing is I had the ability to be underneath Jay Robinson and Marty Morgan and Russell and all these guys that we're talking about. They're just amazing people. And so we had a chance to learn from them. And even in that time, they were always continuing to talk, you know, making small adaptions and changes. And that's important. So for me, I want to build the same, you know, it's the same dreams I want to bring back here, the same experience I had. I want kids to have it here, and I see that we're going in the right direction right now as a program, making some big gains. Our development, I feel like, you know, especially like even back in that era that we talked about, they didn't always have the number one recruiting class, but their development was phenomenal with the guys, and they held the guys accountable, and great things happened. And that's what we're trying to, you know, follow in that same leadership that they'd given to me, and we're using that. But, big thing is, I think, understanding individuals that are, everyone's different. I want the kids on our team that come in to know that this is a family environment, that we expect them to do things right. And we're going to set the bar extremely high. We know who we're chasing, and we know we're not there yet, but hopefully we're getting closer and closer every week to becoming the best team that we can be. And our long-term goal would be a team that could bring home some serious hardware in March, and hopefully in time here, bring home a national title. Would be an awesome dream, you know, for me as a head coach here to get back to that spot. I know it takes time, but that's what our goal is. And so that's what we're working for.
Brandon, I look back throughout the last couple decades, and the vast majority of staff members at Minnesota have been Minnesota grads. You guys went outside the family and brought in Trevor Branvold this year. What made him an appealing candidate, and what has he brought to the table?
I've had a lot of chances, like even as a coach here to coach against Trevor. So I always respected him on the mat. He was very successful, in the coaching world. It changes. You get to walk along the, you know, side of the mat and bump shoulders with some of these guys and talk to them. And during the matches, it'll always get intense, you know, between coaches often. And I think that's what the awesome part of the sport, people trying to, you know, do the best for their program and their kids and stuff. But I really enjoyed the opportunity that I had to spend talking with Trevor, you know, off the mat and just could tell the way he carried himself. I watched the way that the guys on his team there at Wisconsin, when he's coaching there, the way they gravitated towards him. And in the recruiting world, especially with us recruiting a lot of the similar people, I could tell by the kids we were recruiting, the things that they said about Trevor and stuff were very, very positive. So I could tell he was making his impact there. And so just after we interviewed him and talked to him, it just seemed like a really good fit, just with his faith and the way that he looked at his athletes and what the experience he wanted to bring for them, you know, inside their time here at the University of Minnesota. It was a no-brainer here. And since we've got him on staff here, he's done an exceptional job and it's been great to work with. And I see him really making his impact here. And, you know, fortunately for us too, he grew up not too far down the road. And so I think it was something that just was a good fit all around.
You graduated from Minnesota in 2000. The guy that replaced you in your weight class was Damian Hahn. The following season, he's now at South Dakota State. How does your relationship change when someone that you know well takes a head coaching position so close to you?
You know, I mean, I guess the way that I look at it, like Damian was somebody that I was always friends with, and I don't think anything changes because they're a head coach. Like, you compete against these guys and you want to win, but when you have a friendship that's true, you know, I don't think that ever leaves. And so the competitive part on the mat and trying to get recruits, like, that'll always be there. But I always hope the best for him, excited for that opportunity that he had, and he'll do a great job, no question about it, down there. And so I don't think much changes, really. I mean, I think if it, you know, in situations where friendships and things would change so much there, then I think the individuals that would let that happen, they must be looking at it a little bit differently than I would, because the goal here is to help these kids develop and to become the best wrestlers they can be. I know what I want to do for the University of Minnesota, but at the same time, life is short, and I think friendships and relationships that you have along the way are as important as anything else there in the world. So, you know, hopefully nothing would change there. I don't ever see it. You know, we have Roger Kish and Matt Nagel at NDSU as well, and many other guys that we've coached here and other programs and stuff that are out there. So it always seems like, to me, it's the one thing that I enjoy, is I enjoy battling on the mat, but I love it when you get a bump into these guys on the road and see how their lives are unraveling, and, you know, down the road as they're developed, whether it's families and coaching and all those things. Those are things that I think should never change.
In 2006, Dustin Schlater had maybe the best true freshman season in the history of the sport. You have a true freshman right now in Gable Steveson, who is doing some great things as well. Compare and contrast those two and what they brought when they were true freshmen and how they approached the sport to be as successful as they are.
Yeah, I guess the comparison that I make is both of them are just phenomenal competitors, especially the way that their confidence, you know, the way they believed in themselves and the adjustments they could make, that they wouldn't get rattled, expecting and setting the bar for themselves so high was a big step. You know, when they go out and wrestle, that's one of the hardest things is, as a coach, is sometimes you're not just battling the individual, but you're also battling what's going on in the mind of the athlete. And those two guys there, I would say, were equally just, were just very high level guys as a true freshman that believed that they deserved to win and then went out and wrestled that way. And so that's the biggest thing. You know, Dustin, you know, boy, time flies, but when I look back, I'm trying to remember exactly how the matches went in 2006. But, you know, the one thing that I remember is he was just, if you attacked him, he hammered you. And you know, even coming in Division I, wrestling, I think a lot of people thought, well, this is a true freshman, we're going to get after him, we're going to try to rattle him, we're going to wrestle him hard. And the ones that did, he really made him pay. And then he was just tough on top. He got a lot of tilts and a lot of turns there. And nobody seemed to be able to get away from him. So it was just, that's kind of my memory of him. I'd say a little bit, and that's so one of the differences in Gable that I see is Gable's a little, maybe, I would say not as strong on top right now as getting the turns like where Dustin was, but I think that he can get there. I know that he's starting to tilt some people and stuff, which I think is really big for him as he wants to continue to get bonus points and stuff. But I would think, with Gable, the big thing is just that he moves like a lightweight at the heavyweight, and his offensive attacks are phenomenal. He has a lot of different ways to score. I do feel like with Dustin, those that attack him, he can create a lot of opportunities for himself scoring there as well. So, that's probably some of the similarities and differences, I guess, I see in them, you know, in that sense. But the mindset was very similar by both of them, you know, going back to that, they just both believed that they could win. They showed it on the mat. They didn't get rattled. And the bigger the match, seemed like the better they compete. And so, that's pretty cool.
Brandon, talking to Gable down in Fort Lauderdale, he was talking about coming into your room as an eighth grader for RTC practices. What are your most vivid recollections of him in his late junior high, early high school days?
Probably the one that always sticks out to me is I remember when he was young and he was, you know, he's just a young kid and comes in and I'm thinking, wow, he's going to wrestle with all these Division I guys that are hard-nosed kids. I remember wrestling one guy in the room in particular that was a guy that was just very physical. One of the biggest strengths this individual had was that he wrestled extremely hard. And so, especially in an hour and a half practice or 2 hour practice, wrestling this individual by the end of it, most of the time this kid was having his way with guys. And I remember watching Gable compete with him early and thinking, wow, he's wrestling him really well. And they were in some scrambles and getting to his legs. But, this individual had very good defense and his hips were heavy. And I could see a look, you know, on young Gable's face at the time saying, at least in my mind thinking, oh, wow, I'm kind of getting maybe a little bit, overwhelmed here. I thought, you know, as the practice was going on, at least that's what I thought. And this was kind of the unique thing I remember afterwards is, they get in a few more times and the guy picks up a leg and then can't finish and drives Gable into the wall. And, I seen Gable kind of look over at me and kind of winked a little bit when I thought he was, extremely tired. And then he came out and scored the next couple takedowns. And that was deep into the practice. And I thought at that time, wow, that's pretty amazing. He was so competitive. I know he wasn't used to feeling that type of pace and that type of, go and strength, you know, because he hadn't been in a college room much. And so to see him come out and stand up, even though his body was exhausted, and then to come through and be competitive enough to score the next couple points, not give up anything showed where his mindset was even as a young guy. And then from there, you just saw him continue to grow in the room, and he had a chance to wrestle with, you know, the best guys and the best upperweight guys in the world here. Now it's just an incredible field that he has to train with between Hayden and even Michael Crails, who comes in, who was a 3-time All-American, and Tony Nelson. Excuse me, I think I said Hayden Zellmer. And then you look at some of the other guys like Trevor Brandvold, and that was, you know, another great reason to have Trevor with us now when he's going on the road. As I'm getting older, we need a guy that can roll with Gable every day. And I always joke and say I got a family and kids, so I gotta try to be around for them a little bit too, so I can't let Gable squash me. But Trevor jumps in there all the time, and so it's just all in all, he just got a really good group of people to train with, and I can't imagine many that have anything similar to that. You know, so.
Well, you got to go on record, prime against prime. If there's a 4-man bracket, Tony Nelson, Brock Lesnar, Cole Conrad, Gable Steveson, who comes out the winner?
Boy, that's a tough one. And I can't, we talked about this all the time as coaching staffs. Now you throw Gable into the mix. And so time will tell and maybe things will have different ideas. But at this moment right now, it'd be a tough one. But again, as a coaching staff, and this has been going on a long time, even with some of the previous Gopher staff members that have been here at the University of Minnesota, we talk all the time, and the debate goes back and back from Lesnar to Conrad and Tony, and now you throw Gable in there. So I couldn't stick my neck out and try to say what I think or predict in that one, but I know they're all some of the best wrestlers that we've ever had come through the University of Minnesota here, and they've all been in heavyweight, those guys. So that's pretty amazing. So it's a good field to be in, but it'd be a tough one for me to pick. What do you think?
Well, I'm going to go with the guy who's had, to me, the most success. I still got to go with Cole Conrad at this point, because I don't know what Gable's done yet, because he hasn't even been to the NCAA championship. So I'm going with Cole Conrad because he's a big-time wrestler. Seeing him pin Mako at the Dome, I just think he has those intangibles. I'm going with Conrad.
I'm going Gable.
I think I like heavyweight. You know, we talk about that all the time, like I said, but it's hard. I hear what you're saying with Cole. You know, Cole, a lot of people that haven't watched him ask about Conrad, what was he like? And the one thing is, boy, Cole put up a lot of points, too. He was a monster. He was great with underhooks. If he got his hands locked, he could throw guys, but you'd see him hitting low shots. He'd high crotch guys. And then on top, he was just a beast. And Tony the same way. You know, Tony's defense was very good. Now, after college, he's really starting to develop his offense at a much higher level than it was in college. But defensively in college, he was, if you got on his leg, especially in a single leg, it was almost impossible to finish on him. And it got to a point where he was hoping that somebody would shoot on him, you know, or if he could get their hands locked, he just knew even if they're on their feet, eventually he would bring him to the mat and he would usually get the points from there. And then on top, it was, seemed like nobody could get away from Tony, and that did a lot for him as well. So, pretty amazing. And we can't ever forget about Lesnar. Lesnar came in with only 2 years, yeah, you know, with the Gophers. But I remember when we first saw him, it was, we were down at Fargo wrestling at the Bison Open, and that's where we typically use that kind of for our wrestle offs, beginning of the year. And we had Shelton Benjamin, who was a stud, you know, who's in the WWE as well right now with Lesnar, and was a couple time All American from us and came in on a junior college. And then, you know, Brock wins that match, but when we saw him walk on the mat, I'd never seen, I hadn't heard of Lesnar, but to see him walk out and what he looked like was crazy. It was impressive. And the next week he ends up, making his decision to be a Gopher, which was pretty cool. So, a lot of great memories with all those heavyweights, but, I'm going to keep my mouth shut, I guess, on that one.
Hey, real quick, before we let you go, facilities. When we were at the World Championships in Budapest, Joe Russell wanted us to film a little spot about getting new locker rooms. It sounds like you might be having a standalone facility. Give us an update on what that looks like.
Yeah, so with where we're at right now, they've already developed this Athletes Village complex here at the University of Minnesota, and it's a, it was a nice facility already, and they did like a $160 million renovation of it. And so it's really cool. So for the student athletes that come here, everything's in one spot, not just for wrestling, but for all of them. Like you walk through these doors and it's just amazing, cool entrance. It's really, really nice. Like when you're recruiting and stuff. And so this is just all new for our student athletes as well. But you walk through those doors, your trainers are here, your tutors are here. If you want to go see your academic advisors here, I mean, the administration, all the coaches, the nutrition center, the training table where guys eat, it's all inside this building, our weight rooms, our chiropractors, our sports psychologists, you name it, everything is in one building. So it's pretty unique. And so now we have the wrestling room that has been finished, and we've been joking a lot about this. This has been something that's been promised to go for athletes as wrestling athletes, I guess, over the last, since I was getting recruited here, talking about this new room. And so the fact that it's finally done here is pretty amazing. And it's turned out phenomenal. It's right off the entrance and close to basically the center of this, athletes village, which is pretty cool. But, our offices for the coaching staff, and we have a Gopher lounge and a conference room and some really cool stuff. It overlooks it. So it's unique. It's more like what you see in football. Like a lot of times they'll do that over their practice facility, or you see that their offices will overlook like the stadium and stuff. And so that's the look that it gives us. This was a basketball, men's basketball practice facility. So it was a basketball gym. And so We created our office suite in mezzanine that overlooks it. You can walk out on the balcony, and it's just, you know, pretty much almost doubled our mat space. Not quite, but without pillars and corners and all those things, it just makes it so much better. And we're right off the, 12,000 square foot weight room. And then we have our own about $1,100 cardio room that is really nice. So just a good setup. And so, like you said, when you guys did that video with Joe Russell, that's getting into phase two. The next step now is trying to develop our locker room and remodel that and make that, you know, what we want for our current student athletes in the future. And so we had a big fundraiser here with Tony Dungy that was raised over $200,000. I think it was like $260,000 in just a few hours there. And that was amazing. Now, there was some expenses and stuff. So that's why I say I think we covered more than a couple hundred. But we've had some big, very generous donations from other people that have helped with that. So that's what we're raising for. And, you know, with the idea of probably around $500,000 to get this locker room finished and up to standards of what we want. And it's just down the hall from the wrestling room. So you come in here, it's unique. There's wrestling rooms out there that will be bigger at this time. I'm sure they have more mat space or maybe a bigger cardio room or whatever. But I think this is extremely unique because it's surrounded by your academics, nutrition center, and the rest of the staff here. So it's pretty cool. So yeah, we're in the phase. It won't be a standalone. I know you kind of mentioned that it won't be a standalone, but it'll be in the center of this athletes village. And that's exactly what we've wanted. I've been to a lot of standalone ones, and those are really cool and pretty unique. But at the same time, I think sometimes their experience, everybody in wrestling wants to kind of be alone and kind of do their own thing. But I think for the development of student athletes, that it's important that they're around the other students and administration and around these people, like during the 5 years that they're here. So they really develop and get to be involved and communicate with others. And so it's a cool setup. You guys will have to get up here again. Now we're starting to get everything finished and all the branding up on the walls and stuff. It's looking better and better every day, and it's pretty amazing.
I know you got to get to practice, but it is cool that as we talk about connections, you have NDSU with Roger Kish, as you mentioned. You have Damian Hahn at South Dakota State. You have you at Minnesota. You guys all wrestled at 184. You all made the finals. Next time you're on, we're going to ask you who would win a round robin in that weight class with you three. So just be ready for that question.
Well, if I get to answer that one, then yeah, that's a good one there. I'll be ready for that one. All right. I'll save it for the next one.
We will ask
Don't ask those guys. Make sure you only ask me and I'll have the final say.
Yep. That's just between us. No, nobody's going to know except everyone that listens. So we appreciate the time. And all the best as you make the home stretch run. Big Ten championships are in the Twin Cities this year, so hope that goes well.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks, guys.
All right.
Have a great day.
That was Brandon Agham for Andy Hamilton of TrackWrestling.com. I'm Kyle Klingman. You have been listening to On the Mat.
Is part of the Matt Talk Podcast Network. For more wrestling podcasts, head over to matttalkonline.com.